I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I get to sit down with Johnny Owen. That's Johnny Owen, the filmmaker, Johnny Owen, the radio presenter, and that's Johnny Owen, the music aficionado and really nice guy. We had a really nice chat over Zoom during lockdown, and I think you're going to really enjoy this. Johnny and I aren't too far apart in age, so there's lots of sort of parallels, which makes for a really good chat. Before we get on with that chat, just quickly, big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks loads to 76 for producing this podcast to make sure that even in these times where we're having to record remotely, he's a great producer and can give you a really nice sounding podcast. And if you enjoyed this and it's your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then go and have a look in the archives, because there's over 150 episodes with some of your favourite musicians, actors, DJs, producers, comedians. Go and have a rummage and you'll find something that you like. And if you want even more, then I do also put standalone episodes and videos and stuff up each week over on Patreon, so you can support the podcast by getting involved over there. You can find out about all of this at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Anyway, let's get on with the episode. That's why you're here. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Johnny Owen. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, right, we are recording and sitting opposite me via the means of Zoom. It's Johnny Owen. Hello.
How you doing? You all right?
I'm good, thank you, yeah. Before we get on with the playlist, I'm just going to ask you, as this an inevitable question, have you found the last sort of 3 months as Johnny Owen, the man, and Johnny Owen, the creative?
Yeah, it's been an interesting time. You know, it's a time when the world has sort of taken a collective breath as well, I think. You know, obviously, I think the health of the nation and people comes first. You know, that's the most important thing. I think it was something that we had to do. Some things are much bigger than livelihoods and art and all those kind of things. So I was quite proud of the fact that, you know, everybody sort of rallied together and made sure that people were safe. That was the most important thing. Obviously, as time has gone on, we've seen sort of the economy slowly come back to life, and the arts in particular. I think this week it's had a massive boost, really, isn't it, with the injection of cash this got, which I'm really glad of. It was a massive sigh of relief. For me personally, I kind of I learned to cook, which is a terrible thing to do, really. And I was one of those blokes that had sort of like relied on beans on toast all his life, but I learned to cook the basics like veg and chicken and fish for the first time. So I kind of learned to do that. So I used that as an advantage. Tried to get reasonably fit, sort of went for a run most days. And I ended up doing a bit of radio over here as well in the UK. I did some talk sport stuff. So, yeah, you know, in some ways I had, you know, had a decent time of it. It was nice to have a break. It was lovely to spend time with the family, with Vicky and my daughter. So on those, there were positives. But, you know, the most important thing was, you know, that we all rallied together and understood that it was about bigger things than all of us, really, and sort of, you know, looked after people, especially sort of the older and the more vulnerable.
Totally. I mean, another important thing, to me, it looks like you've just had an haircut, mate.
I know. I had one on the, on the weekend. As soon as it was sorted, myself and my partner, Vicky McClure, the actress, we know a guy who's a hairdresser called Louis, who's very good. And he came around and he did us on the morning of my birthday. My birthday fell on July the 4th, which was the day, of course, that the pubs reopened. And
wonderful.
And, oh, yeah, it was a nice present, really, for everybody. So, yeah, he came around and sorted us out. And, you know, I made sure I got a decent haircut because I was desperate for one, mate, I've got to be honest.
All right. Well, let's kick on with the playlist. And for track one, Johnny, I'm going to ask you what you think is the song with the greatest ever intro.
I think it's Hard Day's Night. There's been, you know, I don't know if there's many songs that have had whole mathematical papers written about the chord that that everybody has a great debate over. From what I understand, it's a G on a 12 string with John playing an F on an acoustic. But from what I understand, Paul plays the D note very high up on his bass. And something happened, George Martin explains it really well, where the note rattled around the acoustic guitar of John, and it gave it this sort of this astonishing sort of sound, really, that everybody tries to replicate and can't. I just think it sums the Beatles up, really, that they were kind of like changing space and time without realizing. Yeah. And I love that about what they did as artists, you know, the fact that they were these young men constantly experimenting. I remember reading once about when they were recording Revolver, Harrison used to turn up with bits of paper in his pocket and pull them out, and Lennon would come in and, can we try this and can we try that? So I just think that nothing sums them up like that, the Beatles. I'm a massive Beatles fan, as I've often said. They had a huge effect on me. And I did think about I Feel Fine, which I love as well, because I love the...
Oh, what a record.
I know, and the chord, and the chord's really difficult to play as well. I learned a bit of the guitar, and they were virtuoso musicians as well. That was weird. It's the thing about the Beatles, but also they kind of like... I always felt they were kind of inventing chords. You know, they sort of must have imagined, hey, John, what do you think of this? And, you know, they'd make shapes. And I don't think a lot of the time they probably knew the technical name. They certainly couldn't read music. They often admitted that. But maybe that was an advantage to them because they didn't care. You know, they were confined and they weren't bound in. So, yeah, for me, it's the start of Hard Day's Night. I think the chord is so famous and it's so clever. And it's so instantly recognisable. So many people can tell what the song is. You know, I mean, to write the song that becomes so famous with the opening chord is genius to me.
It's totally genius. And no one's actually chose this, Johnny, but people have mentioned it because, you know, it is just that iconic, what I thought was a cold, but you've now explained it, that it's a multitude of colds, which I had no idea that was the case. So that's great. And I'll tell you what, before we started this, I was just flicking through my social media and I saw that The Streets had just said, oh, it's the first Streets album in 10 years is out tomorrow. Mm. And that seems to be kind of something that is quite commonplace now, where, you know, bands don't do anything for sort of 5 or 6 years, then put out another album. Yeah. And when you think of the time span of the Beatles' entire career and what they done in that short space of time, it's fucking ridiculous, isn't it?
It's preposterous. I mean, there's all those amazing stats, and I think it's something like, isn't it 18 months or maybe even 2 years at the most between A Hard Day's Night and Tomorrow Never Knows? I Want to Hold Your Hand, sorry, and Tomorrow. Yeah. Which is extraordinary, you know. You kind of, if you think that Love Me Do was 1962, and you know, A Day in the Life was only what, 5 years later. It's an extraordinary thing that they progressed so rapidly. Yeah. I remember reading once a famous writer saying that we haven't quite computed yet how good the Beatles actually were. We still haven't sort of qualified it really, because nothing has happened like it in that way since. I mean, we've got great artists, you know, and in all forms of art. But I think they're the greatest artists of the 20th century, because they affected so much. They changed everything. They changed not just music, they changed film, they changed, you know, art itself, you know, with pop art and all those kind of things, and fashion. So I just think that the speed, and like you're saying, it was how efficient they were. The fact that they were going, right, you've got to go in today, you've got to do these gigs, you've got to record these songs, and then we've got to go to these places in this part of the world. And they just did it.
I didn't even consider that. Like, I'm talking about how prolific they were with their songwriting and recording. They obviously were playing stadiums worldwide as well, and making films and God knows what else. It's crazy, isn't it?
Writing books. I mean, like Lennon wrote 2 books, didn't he, in 64 and 65 in his own right, and spanned in the works. Then he did a film, How I Won the War. Harrison was going over to India and hanging around and bringing back Ravi Shankar. Art McCartney in particular was sort of like really invested in the art scene in London in the mid-1960s. So they were the catalyst for everything, I felt, at that time. It was spilling out from London. It wasn't just a music thing. It was, they kind of, I mean, a lot of people say, don't they, that Harrison in particular brought back the sort of the Indian music culture and a lot of other things, from meditation and all those things that we think of as normal now in Western culture, yoga, stuff like that. It all started with them, you know, these Liverpudlians. Yeah. But we're into this kind of thing, and they brought that style of music into music as well. I mean, people often go, oh, yeah, I didn't think of that. I mean, the guy that started probably the most important company of the last 20, 30 years, Steve Jobs, Apple, was a massive Beatles fan and stole their name. I mean, I think they only resolved it 10 years ago. The Beatles were like, well, that was our idea. And their idea was literally what he took on, you know, music, technology, all those kind of things they wanted to do with Apple itself. So, you know, even Apple is kind of like, owes a debt to the Beatles. So it's like their influence is everywhere in everything as well, you know. And then you can just break it down to something like a chord that starts a song, you know, and like you're saying, and then when you break the chord down, you go, there's a lot more going on here than I realised, you know.
I don't think anyone's ever answered that question quite as well as that, Johnny. Track two, mate. I'm going to ask you what the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
It was God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols. I was 6 years of age when punk broke. I was very lucky. I had a brother who was 6 years older than me. So he didn't.
So how, do you mind me asking, how old are you then, Johnny?
Yeah, I'm 49.
Right, okay.
So I was born in 1971. So I kind of remember the first stirrings of punk. It was my first kind of memory really of popular culture. I do kind of remember I remember Grease being out in Saturday Night Fever, and I can remember vaguely Elvis dying. I remember being that on television. My mother's a big Elvis fan, so I remember that. But the thing, the music that I remember most viscerally was my brother, older brother, came home with the Nevermind the Bollocks album, and he played it. He was great, my older brother. He'd have me in his bedroom. He had the box room, and he had a stereo, a proper 70s stereo, and he'd play these vinyl records on it. I wasn't allowed to touch it because I was sometimes he'd let me like hold them in my hand if he was there, and I just got to look at this record. It was great, you know. So it really made me value them as well. You know, I was like, oh my God, this is a single. So I remember him coming home. I remember the colour of it. I remember it being very yellow and pink, you know, the great artwork. I can't remember who the artist was who did it, but the idea was it to be like a ransom note, wasn't it? Which I thought
it's really stark, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, the cut-out letters and that. And then he played Holidays in the Sun and, you know, Marching Feet, and I'm six, you know. I'm in, because I'm straight away. I'm like, yes, what's this? And then the guitar sound. And what I like about what's happened in the last 10, 20 years about the Pistols and that album and the single, it's been reevaluated, because I think McLaren, who was a brilliant spinmeister, a PR man, he did them a disservice in a way, because the album is now seen as a classic and the music on it is fantastic. The way it's recorded, guitar playing, the bass playing, they were a brilliant band, the Pistols. And I know Lydon took exception to the fact that they were kind of dismissed McLaren with the line, they couldn't play, was all part of it. But the irony was, they were a great little three-piece. And God Save the Queen, I think lyrically it's one of the greatest songs ever written. I mean, just the line, they made you a moron, but you're a potential H-bomb. What a line that is. I mean, every working-class kid could associate with that, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're lucky, you'll get a job at the end of it, especially when, you know, I grew up, or we grew up in the 70s and 80s. That was what your hope was. But you're potentially an H-bomb. You've got it all going on.
Yeah.
If you wanted to. I thought Lydon's lyric there was exceptional. And I just think God Save the Queen is still 3 minutes of the most exciting music I can ever... I play it sometimes. I used to DJ back 10 years ago now, quite a lot, the Young Man's Game. And I DJed all over the world, and I was DJing once in Stockholm, a packed club. And they do a night over there called Bangers and Mash, a very British Anglo-centric night. So you can play lots of music, and the kids are great. It's packed over there. And I remember saying to the guys who run it, Robert and Magnus, I'm thinking of playing God Save the Queen. I got God Save the Queen on a 7-inch here. And they were like, oh, chuck it on. They love it. And I was like, would they? And they were like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I played it, and it went down a storm. I'll never forget it, you know. Even though with all these 18, 19-year-old indie kids, it's such an exciting record. And I think there's some records that are like that. Hound Dog is another one. If you play Hound Dog now, it still sounds huge. It still blasts you almost, break on through by the Doors. There's some songs that do that. And God Save the Queen was the song that I felt as a kid, I want to be part of this. I want to be in on this. Whatever my brother's bringing home, I want this. I want to buy these records and I want to listen to it. And I'm in. I'm in with you. And that was the Pistols.
So was that emotion just pure excitement?
Yeah, it was. I my brother and me talk about it often. He says to me, it's great, my brother Chris. He said, you just couldn't stop jumping around the bedroom. He said, I can remember it. It was like as if somebody plugged something into you. That's what he said.
Yeah.
I said, I never get it. He says, I remember it. So you couldn't stop yourself jumping around.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of, and my nephew is 2 now, Dexter. And I played for him Johnny Cash the other day, Folsom Prison Blues live thing. And he asks for it all the time. And I can see what my brother was talking about, where something in us as human beings, I mean, the theories are that your mother's heartbeat in the womb and all those kind
sure.
of... But there is something about beats and music. Everybody loves music. It doesn't matter if you like classical music or, you know, rock music or whatever you like. You will not meet a human being who goes, I hate all music. It's impossible not to like music. And I think there's something it does to us as humans because of what we are, this body carrying around the soul, that it taps into it. It's something that's unique to us.
I think that, and God Save the Queen's a really good example as well. Like it still sounds fresh. It's like there's lots of stuff from that kind of, from sort of 77, around that era, like, of punk stuff that sounds very dated and the production sounds of its time. I shouldn't say dated, I mean of its time. But you listen to Nevermind the Bollocks, that could come out tomorrow and it wouldn't sound out of time. Whether it's the production, I don't know, but it still sounds as huge and as fresh as when it come out. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Do you know, funny thing, Stuart Marconi was saying exactly the same the other day. He was on a programme on BBC Four and they showed the Gods of the Queen. They played Gods of the Queen and they showed the video they did where it's just them playing and he's got the knotted handkerchief on and and it finishes and he's got a few guests with him. They must be doing a discussion on music or something. And it finishes and exactly as you said, he just goes, that still sounds massive. And they still look extraordinary, don't they? And everything that the audience goes, yes, it's still a really visceral thing when you see the young Sex Pistols. They still look like, they still look dangerous, but sexy. And that was the thing with you know, the Sex Pistols and my older brother and all those kind of things that he brought home. They was, excuse me, they were sexy, something sexy, but it was something your parents were saying, oh, be careful of that, don't listen to that, or the punks are this and the bondage trousers, all those kind of things. But I felt, excuse me, I've got something stuck in my throat, hang on. I felt that that only added to it as a kid. You felt, oh my God, I want to know more about this then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is rock and roll, isn't it, I suppose, especially.
Yeah, totally.
It's interesting. I mean, somebody said something the other day that really struck a chord to me. They went, when you're 16 and you watch Don't Look Back with Bob Dylan, you think he's so cool, Dylan, because he's really quite arrogant in it, you know? And they said that when you're 35, you think, oh, he's a bit arrogant. when you get to my age, you think, oh, he's a bit of a wanker there. Do you know what I mean? And it's a bit like, it's like that. I mean, I love Liam Gallagher. I think he's our greatest rock star. Him and his brother are fantastic. The last 20, 30 years, I think they've been superb. But now that I'm older, when I think of them when they were like a 21, I just think, oh, I would have hated to have been their tour manager or looking at them at that time, because they would have been an handful. And that's because that's what rock and roll should be. It's a bit like the thing of if you're still liking music in your 50s that's coming out now, then it's not dangerous enough. Do you know what I mean? It should be annoying you as you get older. And I do agree with that a little bit, you know?
Oh, 100%, 100%. Okay, so for track three, I'm going to ask you the song that reminds you of your time at school.
I'm going to do two here because I got one for primary school, one for secondary.
That's cool.
Primary school, it's a song called Love Plus One by Haircut 100.
Oh, what a record.
I know. And I just, when I used to go to primary school, this was, again, I'm sure my age here now, Stu, but mid-70s, our radio could come through the TV set. We had a Red Effusion wooden TV set, and it was only 4-3 channels. And then then you would go to the radio, so you get Radio 1, Radio 2. And every morning when we got ready for school, me, my two brothers, my mother, she would get ready for work. We'd have Terry Wogan, was then doing the morning show on, I think it might even mean Radio 1, I don't know, but he was on. And that was a song that was number one around that time. And it just really reminds me of getting ready and going to primary school and us all rushing about the house and all the rest. And if I hear it now, I'm back there. I am at 1980 or whenever it was, and I'm about 8-9 years of age, and my mother's going, hurry up and put your socks on. Hurry up. Come on, you're going to be late. And it just reminds me of that era. And that's the great thing about music, isn't it? There's nothing like music for transporting you back to a specific time.
And then, where was school?
It was a place called, I've lived obviously from a place called Merthyr Tydfil, which is in South Wales. Very traditional industrial mining town as it was, and a big steel works. My dad and my grandparents were all from heavy industry, worked underground and things. But that was the norm then. It was unusual if your dad didn't work in the pit or the steel works. So I was from a very ordinary working class background, but very lucky. Great family, great support network of friends, everybody kind of financially in the same boat, holidays, you know, once a year, great Christmases, brothers, football in the street, you know, that almost archetypal working class background. Really, really lucky. And obviously, I'd grown up with comprehensive education, which was very good, you know, universal healthcare. So I'd really like... had a good upbringing, lucky to have a good, loving family, you know, and background. I really enjoyed it. You know, I look back very nostalgically at happy times, really. My dad passed away 2-3 years ago, but, you know, he was 78 and he'd been, he'd lived a very full and rich life. And, you know, I was glad I had him, you know, if I could say that. And my brothers are still living there, and I got nephews down there and stuff. And great friends. I mean, people often remark about it, but I still got the same friends I had when I was in primary school. I still know them, still see them, still, you know, I meet them for a pint, and that'll never change. So, yeah, I was at a good time. And when I went to secondary school, for some reason, it's a song by Simply Red called Holding Back the Years. If I hear that, I'm like 14, 15 again. I mean, comp, start discovering girls for the first time, fashion, football. I'm starting to go to the football and I'm allowed to go with my mates. So, yeah, so that reminds me of that sort of period, is holding back the years. I don't know why. Obviously, Top of the Pops is such a seminal event in the week, and everybody used to talk about it the next day. You know, I was mentioning the other day, somebody said to me, oh, blah, blah, blah. I was going, do you remember when the Aha video came out, Take On Me, the famous drawing video? And he was like, yes. And I was like, do you remember when that was on Top of the Pops? And this lad's from Manchester, he was going, yeah. And I was going, wasn't it, you know, a talking point the next day in school? And he was like, absolutely. And I love those things that, where music and TV programs, The Young Ones was one, and Blackadder, where everybody would talk about it the next day in school and
yeah.
mention the fact they'd see Billy Connolly on Parkinson was another one, you know. Yeah. Everybody, there'd be like seminal events, really. And Holding Back the Years kind of reminds me of that. I just remember that song being out, and you know, I was kind of like the time I was in the Style Council, but for some reason that song transports me to that period.
And I mean, Mick Hucknall gets a rough deal, do you know what I mean? And everything else aside, his voice is incredible.
Oh, people said to me, I was on about him the other day, I was on, oh, I like Simply Red a minute, and they were like, oh, exactly as you said, Steve, is he a guilty pleasure? I was like, fuck off. He's good. I fucking love Mick Hucknall, I love Simply Red. I had Stars and some songs. He wrote some amazing singles. But it's quite cool to sort of give him a bit of a hard time, really, isn't it? But not
yeah.
No, no, no. I don't understand the saying guilty pleasure, because if it's a pleasure, I'm not guilty about it. I'm
completely. Completely.
Yeah. I was a bit like, all right. Johnny Logan. I remember Johnny Logan had two great Eurovision singles that were hits. And I was like, what a fucking tune that was. And guilty pleasure? No. I like it. Great single.
Have you... I mean, I'm not... I quit watching football in 1989, right? But have you watched, because I had Colin Murray on here and he was telling me about Johnny Logan singing
Bohemian. Yeah.
Fuck me. So I went on YouTube and watched it. Have you watched that?
Yes, great.
It's so good.
I know. And the thing is, they're a really cool team to watch now, they are. They kind of, the people fly over to Dublin to watch the Bohemians and St. Pat's to play each other because it's a great weekend, you know?
Yeah.
Dublin, blah, blah, blah. But that's, I just think that's a really, like, I love when football fans are funny like that, when they adopt something and it becomes theirs. And you go, but why? And they go, I don't know. Somebody was in a pub one night, probably pissed, started singing that, and everybody joined in. And I was like, yes, that's what it's about. Do you know what I mean? And
totally.
Their song, isn't it? Yeah.
Shout out to the Proclaimers as well, because Sunshine on Leaf, when you see that, Echo Man of Stadium. That's a bottom lip trembler, that is, mate.
Well, when they won the Scottish Cup for the first 100 years and they sang that, I think that's one of the most beautiful moments in football history ever. I honestly watched that, and everything's in there, because I'm good mates with Irvin Welsh, and he said to me that when we sang that, we sang it for all our fathers and grandfathers and died.
Oh,
never seen that. And I was like, oh, wow. Do you know what I mean? And the line, while I'm worth my room on this earth. What a line that is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, mate. What a great band. Great band they are. So, did you enjoy school?
Yeah, I was all right. I think with school for me was, I mean, I won't lie, South Wales as an industrial area was great, but it could be tough in the sense of, like, everything was about how hard everybody was. So it was like, what's he like? Is he hard? Is he not? So you had a lot of that that went on. But I wouldn't change any of it. Do you know what I mean? It was a good apprenticeship for life, I think, going to school in South Wales in that time. Yeah. I had to sort of be, either learn to sort of fight, run quickly, or use your mouth. It was one of those things, and that's fine, because that kind of prepares you for life.
Merthyr had one of the greatest fighters ever, right?
Yeah, exactly. Merthyr's produced a lot of world champions, Howard Winstone, Jimmy Wilde, Johnny Owen, you know, the matchstick man.
The matchstick, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a tough town with a big heart, I always say, and, you know, you've got to be on your toes. But the thing with school for me was, I kind of left school getting through, and I only left with 4 O-levels, and I kind of, like, got a job then in the local Hoover factory as a computer boy. My dad, get into computers, it's the future. Or, you know, no interest in it, but I got into it, and I was very lucky I had a job. And then what happened to me was, I kind of got to about 18, 19, and I noticed the student recruitment for Hoover. What they do is they'd recruit students who've got a degree, and they'd be trained as managers. And I can remember actually going, that I would never get there in 20, 30 years because they are taken from the... So I for the first time, I understood where people in the past had said to me, if you work in school, it means you've got more of a chance of this happening. And I understood it for the first time there because I'd seen it in a very physical way of somebody coming in straight from university, being trained as management and being in charge of a division. So my department shut down in Hoover's and I was offered redundancy. I was only like 20, I think, and it was a few thousand pounds. So I thought, I'm going back to education. So I went back and I did some extra O levels and an A levels, and then I got into university. So I left university at about, what was it, 23, 24. But I got the degree. I thought to myself, I'm going to get a degree. And again, it shows how old I am. I had a grant to go and I left without any debt because I didn't pay for it. And this was the early 90s. So I just caught that thing of where it didn't cost and you got a grant to go. So very lucky in that respect. But I did kind of keep my head down in school and just think, well, I'll get through this, and didn't take advantage of it in the way that I probably should have. My dad's up. If my dad is upstairs listening down, we go, I've been telling him this for years. Do you know what I mean?
The Killer Tricks Future Weapons EP is out now. Seven tracks. Listen on all the major streaming platforms or find out where to buy in the show notes. It's badass. Like me, the sexy robot lady. Ooh yeah, baby. Right there. That's good. K-I-L-L-A-T-R-I-X.co.uk.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, well, look, we'll pick back up on that kind of eerie life, because I'm sure that's going to sort of come into track five. But for track four, I'm just going to go back again, Johnny, and ask you the first song you bought from a record shop.
Right, the first record I ever bought from a record shop. I was saying people lie about this, don't they? But I wanted to buy Summer Lovin' from Greece, because I seen Greece in the pictures. I'd only been about 7 years of age, but I loved it. Because of the music and all the rest of it. And my mother took me, and I can remember queuing for hours to get in because it was a big thing. I'd seen that, and I think Star Wars was either the summer before or around the same time. But I seen Star Wars, and I loved Star Wars. I was, like I said, I was the perfect age for it. And to the point where it's a bit of a family story where my mother, I insisted on being called Luke. So she'd call me for tea, she'd go, Jonathan! And I wouldn't come. And then she'd go, Luke! And I'd come running there. Change my name. And then I seen Greece, and I really enjoyed Greece as a kid. I thought, oh, this is great. So I can remember the first single going to Woolworths and going, and this is really funny. I went in and I went, I was with my mother and father. I went, can I get the Greece song? And I meant Summer Lovin'. And of course, they got me the theme song, which is "Greece Is My World." Is "Greece Is the World" by Frank? I think it's Frankie Valli or whatever.
It's Frankie Valli, yeah. One of the greatest intros ever.
Yeah, absolutely. But I got home and I was devastated because it was the wrong song. And of course, I couldn't go back to town to change it. It was about 6-7 o'clock, but then the pub shops to shut 5 o'clock. So I was like, ah. So then on the Monday, I think my mother went in when I went to school and changed it for me. So the first single I ever bought was "Summer Lovin'" from Grease, but it wasn't. It turned out to be the theme song, which is Grease, which is a better song, I realise now.
It is a better song. I think you've done all right there.
Did all right, yeah, yeah. But I changed it because I was disappointed that it wasn't the song that I wanted. But I remember that for the first time, my mother and father, they didn't buy me a record player, different times then. They'd managed to get hold of a almost like an old dance set thing that was a fold. It must have been from an uncle or maybe my grandfather. And that was given to me for that record to play. And that was mine then. So I had an old stack so I could start buying singles. But I didn't buy one for a long time after that for some reason. I don't know why. But I definitely remember the first single that I bought myself, where I would sort of, you'd say that was Add Some Tears, was I bought Strange. Yeah. By the Jam. I bought the Jam Strange Town because I seen Paul Weller on Top of the Pops. And it's on YouTube now. He's got shades on. His hair's immaculate, as always. He's got a boating blazer on, a polo, Rickenbacker. And I can remember watching it. And I can literally remember going, oh, that's him. I want to be him. I'm done. I'm the Paul Weller. He's the one. And I became...
I'm done with Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, he's had it. John Travolta, they've all gone. I became a Jam fanatic, and I was one of them that I bought everything, got everything on bootleg, tapes. I became a bit of a fanatic. I'm fair with my older brother. My older brother said to me, that's when I realised you had a bit more of the obsession than I did when it came to music and the arts. He said you were off trying to find stuff, spending hours going through singles and all the rest of it. And when, on about my 40th birthday, I went back to an old school reunion. And a lad had flown over from Australia, was in school with me, Nick. And the first thing he walked up to me, he said to me, are you still obsessed with Paul Weller? I was like, yes. He remembered from school I was obsessed with Paul Weller. And I was like, yes, I am. And he was like, oh, he said it. And I can remember he was into heavy metal. He used to have like AC/DC on the back of his jacket.
Brilliant.
I remember saying to him, I quite like AC/DC now. And he's going, I quite like the Jam now. But in them days, because it was the Tribes, who weren't allowed to like sort of cross over. But yeah, so that
it's such a shame. Like, I know I teeter on, you know, old man territory when I start talking like this, but there doesn't appear to be that much tribalism in music anymore.
No.
And, you know, throughout the whole of my life, there was so much of it everywhere, in every kind of movement in music. There was always another couple alongside it, and you chose your, you know, whatever T-shirt you was going to wear. You know, you'd wear your band T-shirt to show off your colours. And
it was dangerous. People would fight for it, wouldn't they? Do you know what I mean? If you went to town on a Saturday and the skinheads were there or the rockers and you were walking along in your parka, you know, in your Target T-shirt, you were a target, literally. You know, they come after you. So it was so tribal. You know, that's what, I suppose, that was what, you know, the beach fights were and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
Kind of like it was a kid's way of going, well, I'm into this. And if you don't like it, then I'll fight you over it. Yeah, you don't get that anymore. More's the pity.
Well, you mentioned some things earlier that were like, you know, like the Young Ones and things like that were like a kind of rite of passage at school. You know, everyone watched the Young Ones. You know, everybody watched Top of the Pops. Like, just talking on your love of Weller and stuff like that. You know, for me as well, I'm a year younger than you, Johnny, but Quadrophenia was the thing at our school as well. That was like, that was up there with the Young Ones. That was the thing that we would just watch over and over and over again on VHS or Betamax, whatever it was. And like that was just as important as anything, you know.
Massive. I say it all the time in interviews and people must be bored of me saying it, but I my older brother, again, bless him, Chris, he got me a VHS of Quadrophenia. It must have only been out in cinemas, and it might have been a bootleg because I was too young to go to the cinema to watch it. And obviously there was stuff in there that I wasn't really quite sure of. And years later, I watched it back, you know, my poor mother and father, you know, me watching it, and I was being, you know, 10 at the most, and there's wanking in there and shagging, there's all stuff going on. You're like, but I've watched that film more than any other film. in my life. So it's the film, without a shadow of a doubt, has had the biggest influence on me in my life. No two ways about it. Music, the story. And it's still a great film. I mean, I know the anniversary was last year.
Last year.
And it was, you know, Phil Daniels was saying, oh, you know, some of the dialogue's a bit clunky, and but actually, you know, it still kind of stands up. And I was going, well, mate, you've been too hard on yourself. It absolutely still stands up. If you play that to a young kid now, they get it. It's a bit like what I was saying earlier on about the way Bob Dylan ages, you age, you know, and you look back and go, well, he's a bit arrogant because he's young, because that's what happens when you get older. You can look back at people, the way they act when they're 21, and you go, I can't believe I was into the way they acted. But Quadrophenia as a film, it's a great film. And it still stands up, and it's still one of the best sort of teenage stories that's been put on celluloid, I think, of what it's like to be that age, you know, when everything's going on, 100%. With hormones and your mates and all the rest of it. And you're right, I mean, Quadrophenia had a huge effect on me. A bit later, a mate of mine got a really early edition of Trainspotting. A guy called Mark Evans, who was quite high up in the Welsh Football Association now, he ran a fanzine in Merthyr called Dilem for Merthyr, which was great. And he said to me, oh, there's a guy who writes for Rebel Inc., which is a fanzine in Scotland, called Irvin Welsh. This was before Irvin had ever been published. And I was like, all right. And he goes, God, you got to read his stories. They're brilliant. And then he managed to get all the Trainspotting, and that blew my mind when I read that. I was like, wow. Astonishing. So like you say, in Quadrophenia, you know, Never Mind the Bollocks, you know, the books I Trainspotting, you know, certain paintings, like Lowry's paintings, where when I was a kid and I first seen them, I was like, God, these are amazing. You know, the Matchstick Men and going to the football match and all that. And I was like, oh, there's nothing better than when art moves you that way, you know. And Quadrophenia, for me, is the film that kind of like affected me the most, definitely.
And just to touch on record shops before we move on to the next question a little bit more, did they become a more important place for you as you grew up? Because your observation of the sort of snootiness in record shops in Svengali was so on point.
It was funny because we had one in Merthyr called Music Mania. There was also a stall in the market, which was brilliant, and that sold badges and patches and things like that, you know. So that was a great place to spend 2-3 hours. But the thing was when you went to Music Mania, and Smith's had a good section in Merthyr as well, there would be other lads and gangs, you know, like I say, heavy metal kids and rockabillys hanging around. It took a while for you to become to be accepted to go in there to hang around long enough to pick your record, if you know what I mean. You know, you kind of like, you got the looks, and do you need any help, mate? And, you know, you can't, I remember somebody saying to me, and the shame of it, you know, because I was going through fanzines, and I was going through the mod fanzines, all Fire and Scale and all those kind of things, and somebody going, you can't spend more than 5 minutes looking through them, man, you've either got to buy one or fuck off. Okay. And I was like, I'll have this one. You know, I couldn't pick it. I was just like, oh, just, you know, he was like, don't think you can spend all morning in here, mate, while they're having a cup of tea with all their pals. Those kind of stuff I remember really well. But I would spend hours in Merthyr and Cardiff going through those kind of places if I could, you know, once you got there. I mean, and I think it was Virgin that did that, and so certainly in London in the 70s, and I know Rough Bay did, where they allowed people to be in there for a long time with headphones on, listening to stuff, didn't they, and all that. So it was kind of like they were aware that people wanted to do it, but they wouldn't allow you in some places. They'd say, do you not go on you go.
Okay. Track 5, Johnny.
Yeah.
The song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Do you know, it's a song by a band called 808 State. A song called Pacific State.
Oh.
And I was really lucky. I went to Ibiza, when I was about 18 with the lads, 19. And I went twice over about a period of 3 years. And then I got to know some lads. I mean, how lucky was this? I met a girl basically from Manchester when I was 18, on my 18th birthday out in Spain. And I arranged to go meet her when I was back in Manchester. And her friends had some lads who they were going out with, and I got really pally with them. I'm still mates with them to this day. And literally, this is 88, 89, they were going, it's pretty good up here. Now, they weren't going to mean, oh, it's Manchester and it's bands and it's Mondays and Roses and it's clubs. They just went, it's good up here at the moment. This is just great clubs and...
Was that just on the cusp of it, like, blowing up?
Yeah, just sort of as it was hitting. And they were like, And I've spoken since to people from Manchester that I've got to know really well, like Sean Ryder and Manny and Joe Hartley. And I was like, oh, do you know what? I wasn't really like, when I went there, it wasn't about the Hacienda and all that stuff, which was going on, obviously. I used to go up to a place called Butterflies in Oldham, which used to have a room for like soul and then a room for disco and a room for like other stuff. And that's when I first heard ADHD. And fair play, they've all gone, yes, that's what we used to do. And I was like, I'm not blowing my mind about Manchester. And I'll never forget this. And this sums the 80s up, ladies up in Britain. I couldn't believe the clubs were open after 1 o'clock because they shut down in Wales.
Yeah.
And I was like, what time is the club shut? And they were like, well, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, wow. And then at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you'd leave and they'd go, do you want something to eat? You're hungry. I'd be like, can you eat? You know, this is like 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, in Wales, you know, you're in bed. And I was like, they were like, yeah, we'll go and get a curry. So I was like 18 in Manchester, and I'd been to a club, and I'd heard 808 State, and I'd heard, you know, these songs. I'm starting to hear, like, they'd play the Mondays, and they'd play disco in amongst it, and they'd play, like, the Jackson Sisters, and they'd play Strawberry Fields by the Beatles, and then they'd play, like, you know, something by, Joy Division. It was amazing. And that kind of blew my mind a bit. They'd play all this eclectic stuff, because in South Wales, they were just playing Stock Aitken and Waterman. And even though the clubs were good laugh and it was with my mates and all the rest of it, I remember going to Manchester and them going to me, oh, you don't need to wear shoes to get in. And I was like, you've got to wear like a shirt and tie in Wales. Genuinely, you had to wear a shirt and tie to go up in Cardiff on Merthyr. It's like 88. And they were like, no, you can get in jeans. I was like, wow, you can get in jeans. They were like, yeah. So I, like, you know, you could get in jeans, you could hear all different types of music, and then you could have something to eat at 5 o'clock in the morning. I thought, this city is fucking amazing. That was Manchester. And everybody I've spoken to was on my Manchester was like, yes. The other stuff, which is like written about and talked about, a lot of that is like, it's whatever you want it to be. And people have different experiences. But what Manchester was at that time, it was opening up. It's the only way I can describe it. It was opening up, Manchester was, in a different way. And the rest of the countries then began to follow suit after that in the years following. So you started to have clubs that just played dance music and you could go in with trainers and then people would end up in fields raving and all that. And I remember it. I remember the feeling of being in Manchester and going, you know, I can wear jeans out on a Saturday night and it's no problem to get in anywhere. Do you know what I mean? And that was a revelation for me.
I think that's, the era you talk about there, like that sort of 88, 89, just the movement in music and culture was so huge then.
Mm.
And I think, like, and you're so right. Like, I live in Essex and, like, literally everything around here was a fucking paisley tie and a shirt to go in a fucking nightclub.
Yeah.
And, like, and you'd have to listen to music you didn't particularly like.
Yeah.
And then at like, 1 o'clock, you'd get, there'd be a slow section where you would ask a girl for a slow dance.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that about? Like, it's crazy. The thought of doing that now, just like, right, we're going to slow things down now. You know, this is Alita Adams.
Yeah. And my mate said a great thing the other day. He said to me, if George Bob Michael was on singing Careless Whisper and you hadn't got a girl to dance with, then you may as well fuck off and get chips and go. It's so true, isn't it? It's like, if I was playing, we're still on the side of the dance floor, forget it, son, it's not happening tonight. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah,
we're going to dance again. Where are you from, then? Down here.
Oh, brilliant. What did you want from clubbing, Johnny?
What did I want, sorry?
What did you want from clubbing?
Good music. I did like it when they played music that, you know, I think that's what Manchester did for me. And then Glasgow was a bit like that when I went there, where I loved it when they would drop something like I remember being in Glasgow in a famous club called Fury Murray's, and they dropped Get Off My Cloud by the Rolling Stones. And I remember thinking, this is great. This is what it should be. You know, and I loved that. I loved the fact you could listen to different songs and they'd play some dance stuff and they'd play some disco, a bit of Northern Soul. I liked the atmosphere in a good club. I liked the fact that it could go on for as long as you wanted it to. And I liked the social side of it as well. I liked the fact that you'd meet up before going to a club and then you'd come after the club, you'd go, you know, something to eat and you'd all stay together. It was just a great social thing, I always felt. Do you know what I mean? If you found a good nightclub and you had good mates. And even now, like, you know, the lads I used to go clubbing with, like I said, I still know them. We don't go anymore, we're too fucking old now. But, you know, it's like, but we, you know, we all reminisce about it. because you've got that energy when you're young as well. You know what I mean? It's just like, I know people talk about drink and drugs and all that, but God, when you're 18, 19, it's amazing how much energy you've got that you're able to just go all night, right through the night. You know, you just are, aren't you?
So are you, what's your thoughts on like nostalgia and in regards to bands coming back and playing that album or because a previous guest of mine, another Johnny, I'm sure if I remember rightly, he said he went to see the Stone Roses with you.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I went to see Stone Roses. I mean, there's a famous saying about nostalgia. Art is just is an exercise in tweaking nostalgia or something. And there's a lot of truth in that. I've been speaking about it all afternoon with you now, talking about songs that take me back to my childhood and all that. It taps into something, doesn't it? In the human memory. And, you know, I remember my mate saying the other day, he was working on the Take That reunion tour. And he went, mate, it's just full of 40-year-old women drinking Prosecco going mental because they're all 18 again. You know, yeah. And they're up with their friends. They've all had kids now. They've all lived the life. But chance for them to act like they were when they were 18 again. It was a bit like that for the Stone Roses with me. Obviously, I went to see the Stone Roses. I'd seen them in Spike Island. I was a big fan. Because when I went up to Manchester those first few times, my mates up there were like, oh, there's a band called the Stone Roses. I kind of heard of them. I think a mate of mine had Sally Cinnamon, or maybe even a song before that that was on Revolver, the Revolver label. So I was aware of them. But then when I seen them, and I thought they looked great as well, I was like, oh, I'll have these. So I kind of, I was probably a good example of somebody who was reliving being 18, 19 again when I went to see them at Eaton Park. But I did it, interestingly enough, Stu, in a very different way. So this is what I often say to people. When I did it when I was 18, I drove in my mini metro from South Wales with my brother and my mate Stevie Deacon, who's still a mate of mine now. We abandoned the car in the middle of Widnes, I think it was, whatever it was. And a copper said to us, yeah, just stick it whatever you want. I'll never forget it. It was like cars up on, you know, on banks, grass banks, just like, yeah, whatever. So we walked into where they played. There was no, like, stall selling anything that I remember. Certainly not, like, food or beer or gourmet burgers or any of that nonsense. It was just young people, all dressed in a very specific way. And we seen the gig. I think, you know, we didn't drink anything because there was nothing to drink. We just had water with us. And you know, because that kept us hydrated. And then, you know, we were up and then we watched the gig. We came back to the car in the early hours, tried to drive back to South Wales. My brother was on about this the other day. Fell asleep in two services on the way. And we got back to Wales with the sunrise the next morning. And one of the service stations was the first time that I found out you can't stay there for more than 2 hours. Because we fell asleep and somebody came and knocked the car. I mean, boys, we were like, all right. We get back to South Wales. And that's what I did when I was 19. When I was 43 or whatever it was, I went with Adidas in a private car. They put me up in the Lowry. I went in the VIP bit. I met the Stone Roses. I was a side of stage. I had like wood-fired pizza. And I did it that way. And I'm glad I did it that way because I wouldn't want to do it the 18-year-old way.
Well, you weren't the right, yeah? You put the graft in.
Put the graft in, exactly. But I'm glad I did it like that then. But I would never in a million years do it that way now. But it was a really funny moment where, I don't know who designed it, but the VIP bit was literally just like a gap in between the crowd divided in half, like a walkway, with just some raised chairs. So you sat in this raised chair, and can you imagine? You all go in and sit down. It's me and Shane Meadows and Vicky's there, and there's other, you know, people from, you know, Soaps and all and sort. And of course, 2,000 manks turn around and go, "Ah, oh, it's you lot, is it?" You know, and they start talking to you and shouting to you, and can I come here? And, you know, can I do a selfie? And you're like, "Yeah, yeah, blah, blah." And in the end, because obviously, you know, it was just getting mad that everybody was all the time. They took us into the sound booth. And we got a seat in the sound booth, which was amazing because we got all the beauty of it all, the light show and everything. And we went into the sound booth and then they took us back after the gig to where the Stone Roses sort of families were, where they had a bit of a decompress. And they were lovely. And I got to know Manny quite well, Vicky Knows, Ian Brown. And we had a bit of a chat with them and all the rest of it. And Manny is just, I remember him telling me a story after he went to me. He was not skint, but you know, he was just getting by. And he two summers before, we DJed together in Brighton, and he had to sell his scooter to take his missus, and I think his boys might have been born then. He's got twins. And he had to sell his scooter to take them on holidays. And I remember him saying to me, then the Stone Roses met, I think, again at his mother's funeral, started talking, decided to reform, and obviously got their payday, which they deserved for reforming. And he's got a bank account in the Co-op in Stockport. And he goes down after they've signed the things. No idea. It's just giving his... And he puts it, and he's got £1 million in his current account. So his accountant's going, fucking hell, you're going to get taxed to death on that. You can't do that. So anyway, he's like, oh, okay, we'll do whatever. But that was what it was like for the Stone Roses and something like Manny. Suddenly, he was a millionaire again because the Stone Roses had decided to reform. And I was a bit like, well, I like that story. I like the fact
That's incredible.
He's got his comeuppance again. Do you know what I mean? He's got what he deserves. And I think when I hear that, I go, well, I don't mind that then. And I always think about Noel and Liam, and I'm a big Oasis fan. I think them two are terrific. They're brilliant. They're a hoot in interviews. And I think they've been great rock stars. And I like the way Noel says every so often, well, maybe I'll reform if I'm ever, you know, if I'm skint again, because that'll be worth like £100 million, them coming back together.
Oh, my God. Imagine. And
it was a bit like an insurance pension policy for them, maybe, during. But yeah, I did it in two very different experiences that were sort of reflective of my age at that point in my life, I think, Stu.
Okay. Let's take it back to your home county. Track 6, Johnny. Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Do you know, it's a really, really modern one, funnily enough. There's a young band that came from Merthyr Tydfil, and they were called Pretty Vicious. And they were signed in a blaze of publicity about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. Every record company was after them. And then they imploded in a way, bless them. They're only young lads, lovely lads as well. And for whatever reason that was, I don't know, but it was such a shame because they released an album then, I think end of last year, and they'd split up, you know, they decided to pack it, and they're still only in their early 20s, and they got signed in their teens on the back of a demo, which was very, very good. But the album's terrific, and they're Merthyr boys, and I think the singer, Brad, who wrote the song, he's back in Merthyr living now, but they're well worth checking out. They're called Pretty Vicious.
What's it like?
And yeah, and they're really good, and they're from Merthyr, and the album. I'm trying to think what the album's called. Let me tell you. Oh, the album's called, there's a song on it called. It goes, oh, don't ever let them win. You'll beat yourself to death just to be here. It's fantastic. I think it's called something like that. Don't ever let them win, and it's well worth checking out. And I think that's my favourite song anybody's ever produced from my town or county by a band called Pretty Vicious, and it's all within the last 6 months this album came out.
Well, we put a Spotify playlist together to accompany this podcast, so I'll make sure there's some tracks by them on there.
Yeah, well, I'll send you I think it's called that. I play it quite a lot. Anyway, it's great.
Did you ever see a Welsh band called Terrace play live?
What are they called?
Terrace. T-E-R-R-I-S.
Terrace.
They were managed by the guy from 60 Foot Dolls. I remember that.
Oh, I remember the 60 Foot Dolls. They were great. They would have been one of my other choices. The song called Stay.
Ah, Stay. What a tune.
Great song. And I thought they were really unlucky. They kind of just missed as well. I mean, they got signed and they did all right. But, you know, the Stereophonics kind of became massive, you know, justifiably. I think Kelly's got a great voice, you know, and they were some brilliant. I mean, the early stuff of them, like Local Boy in the Photograph, what a song that is. But yeah, the 60 Foot Dolls, they were a great band as well. Was it Richard in them? Richard is... So Richard, he's a lecturer now, I believe, in music at the University of Bath, I think, because he's on my Facebook page, Richard Parfitt. But he was I say old mod, because I can say that, because I'm an old mod, but he was a lad who was a Weller fanatic as a young man as well. And I bumped into quite a few times because I was in a band myself, and I got to know them all quite well, and everybody knew each other really, because Wales, you know, it is a village, you know, and there's the cliche that we know each other, we're all related, and we don't help ourselves. Where, you know, somebody will say to you, "Oh, do you know so and so, so and so?" And you go, "I don't know everybody," and they go, "Yeah, Dave Jones from Ponty." "Oh yeah, I know David." So you can't help us. But he, I did know Richard. I thought the $64 were terrific, but no, I don't remember. I viewed the name. I think what kind of band?
They were like. It was like we was playing with them and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong. Don't hate me for it. Club Iverback?
Yes, Club Iverback.
That one.
Yeah.
so we were supporting them, and there was this big sort of furore about this new band, and I remember seeing them and just thinking, right, well that's me done in music. This is so exciting. They didn't have a bass player. They had a little guy on, like a little 303, and the front man was a bit Ian Curtis like, but. It was, but they ended up getting signed, and they got on the cover of NME as the most exciting new band out of like the UK, and then it just seemed to just fold for them. I don't know what happened, and it was not many people remember them, but I remember just seeing them and thinking, still to this day, one of the greatest live things I've ever witnessed, and enough to the point where it made me just think, oh, I'm done with bands. I can't get anywhere near that.
Yeah. I think the thing with me was I kind of was in a band, and you know, we did all right. We were signed, and we were playing up in London. We had some big supports. We got this one in excess, and we played with like Stereophonics and Cooler Shaker. But I got to about 24, 25, and then I was offered a part in a drama, which was 9 months and decent money. And I had a bit of a thing where I thought to myself, God, not only. You form a band and you go, right, we're going to get signed. And it's really hard to get signed. I mean, really hard. And then you do it. You think, right, I've done it. And they go, no. Now it starts. Now you've got to make it big. And when you make it big, you've got to stay there. And I'm thinking, fuck it, hell. There's only a handful of bands that do that. You know what I mean? And I just thought, I've got another option here of earning money and staying involved in the arts. And that's why to this day, you will never hear me bad mouth in any band or artist, because I always think, well, you know what, you're on your own journey to get there, and you've done all right. Do you know what I mean? You've done all right to do what you're doing.
Totally, and more so now. I mean, like, you know, when we was doing like my band and stuff in the 90s, there was, you know, little pockets of money about if you sold records, but you know, and a lot of the labels back then would give you an option on your second album. If you don't sell records now, you ain't ever getting that second album. And it's like, that's what I think is missing. I do think there's certain labels that do that. Obviously, some of the sort of the better indies do that. But, you know, the major labels, you get that elusive record deal and you think you're home and dry. And then if your first record don't shift X amount of numbers, they're not going to reinvest in you to get that second album out of you. And I think that's a real shame.
It's a massive shame, because it was so important to British culture in the late 20th century. You know, it made a lot of money for the government for a start, but also it was kind of central to our identity. We always felt, didn't we, in Britain, you know, especially after the 60s, that our bands were kind of like, was a sign of quality if we were British bands, you know, some of the best bands in the world. And it's a shame that's not, you know, I mean, people would say that there's still massive British bands that do well across the world, and absolutely, but I think the last band you could probably say that came through where there was a huge buzz around was probably the Arctic Monkeys, I'd say, you know, where there was a young band that people were going wow about. I don't really think there's been anybody since then that have had that kind of effect, and that's a shame really, John. What's that now? That must be about 10, 15 years ago now, isn't it? And it used to be sort of five-year cycles things would happen, but that is definitely extending now, and I love dance music. I love dancing, but I was much more into bands and going to live gigs because I just like lyrics. I liked songs that spoke to me. You know, I liked luring things that reminded me of my life and spoke to me about my life. Do you know what I mean? As in the word Morrissey, but that's why I was much more of a band person than a rave person. Do you know what I mean? I went to dance nights and I did, but I was always much more I like bands. Do you know what I mean? Seems to be something that's I shouldn't say dying out, because festivals are still huge, aren't they? That's the thing. Yeah. But there's a different way. I mean, I think from what I understand, live venues are contracting, aren't they? There's not as many as there once was.
It's so difficult. I run a live venue, Johnny, and I have done for, you know, I've been there for 30 years, and it's just seeing it change. Whereas that, yeah, they're dropping like flies, and it's a shame. And I just hope and pray that what's left is going to come out of this intact.
Yeah. Are you getting any help from the government? Will you get any help for the?
Hopefully we will, but as it stands at the moment, no. So it's been quite strange, but yeah, fingers crossed, mate. You know,
yeah.
I'm sure. You know, it would appear that, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel at the moment. So let's hope it's slow and steady, and we get out of this, and we can open our doors when everyone's safe to come in. You know,
I hope so.
Last track, Johnny.
Yeah,
you can be DJ again. A song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
There's a band that, in a parallel universe for me, should be huge, but they didn't. But they were called 530, and they were a band from Oxford, and I absolutely loved them. I was a fanatic. And
they played my venue twice.
Did they? I went to see them live. I thought they were absolutely amazing. Blew me away. They were a bit one of those bands where I thought afterwards, I might as well pack this in, because they just had everything. They looked fantastic. They could play. They were powerful. They were three-piece songs. And for some weird reason, it just didn't catch fire for them. But I have so many conversations with people every so often. I'll go, I was reading a band called 530. And people go, yes, I love 530. I'm thinking of getting a T-shirt or something so I can wear it around, and people will go, like some secret club or something. But I met Paul Bassett after, who was the guitar player. It was lovely. He was in a band later called Orange Deluxe, who did okay as well. And Tara Milton, who was the bass player, he's on my Facebook. I think he was in the New Biles after. But the 530 were just an amazing band. They re-released all their stuff, like remixed and everything, and sort of like, I think somebody did a job of like sort of making it, you know, where they sort of say, oh, it's in special stereo or whatever now, you know, it's
sure.
Like way of getting stuff out. But there's a song, the album is called Bed. It's a great album. They had a few singles off there. And there's a song that opens it up called Supernova. So I'd recommend that's called. It's on YouTube as well. There's a few songs of theirs on YouTube. 13th Disciple is amazing. You. But I'll go with Supernova just because it sounds like West Coast British psychedelia out of Oxford and Reading in the mid-90s. You know what I mean? It's got everything you can imagine a band should be at that time. It's just beautiful. And loads of energy, great guitar playing. And it's a tune. It's a real tune, and they look great as well. And I know they were signed to East West, and they got a good deal, and they had proper management and all the rest of it. But from what I understand, the lads in the band, fell out, and therefore, didn't have the career they should have had. But I would recommend anybody that likes music should try and get into 530. They're terrific.
Oh, I never thought anyone had mentioned 530 on here. That, what a joy. Love it. All right. Well, before we wrap things up, Johnny, when we come out of this lockdown situation that we're in properly and everyone goes back to work, what's coming up for you, mate?
Well, I've got a film coming out again in end of this year. It was meant to come out in spring, but obviously with everything that happened, it's coming out what they call Q4 in cinema world. So you have like four parts of the year. So now I'm in autumn 2020, and it's called The Three Kings. And it's a story about three very famous Scottish managers, Bill Shankly, Jock Stein and Matt Busby, who were all lifelong friends and kind of founded these dynasties in Manchester United, Liverpool and Celtic. So it's their story and what they did and what they achieved, and kind of like how they invented modern British football in a way. The great, legendary Scottish managers. So that comes out in the autumn. I got obviously the show on TalkSport, Johnny Owen and Friends, which has started brilliantly. I've got Paul Weller on this weekend, so I'm quite pleased about that. I got to know Paul a little bit now, which is amazing, really. Do you know what I mean?
Wonderful.
So I'm doing that as well. And obviously, I do some stuff for Nottingham Forest these days. I look after their commercial side and media and communications and stuff. So it's great. You know, I'm busy. I'm very lucky because obviously I understand at the moment that it's difficult for a lot of people. The arts are, I've said this quite a lot in interviews, these last 3 months, and when people often in life will talk about the arts and why are we spending money on that and how important are the arts, not many people, look to maths equations or the periodic table this last 3 months, did they? You know, they listened to music, they read books, and they watched films. That's how important the arts are. You know, when it was when everybody needed something to pick me up, pick themselves up, they looked to the arts. So that's why it's really important. You look after music venues, and you look after theatres, and you look after bands, and you look after all these things. You know, they're not superfluous. That's nonsense. They're actually really, really important. They're integral to our existence as human beings. So I'm hoping that it all comes roaring back to life soon.
I can't add anything to that, mate. Perfect. Johnny, thank you so much for your time today, mate. It's been a real pleasure. It's
been a pleasure, Stu. Thanks very much for having me. Take care.
Thank you. There you go. Johnny Owen, what a top fella. Really, really nice chat. Yeah, can't say enough good things about him. You know, great taste in music, and it was really nice of him to give up some time to have a natter with me about some of the records that have been important in his life. I'm back next week. Thanks loads to you lot for listening and supporting this podcast. It means a lot. Like I said at the beginning, if you want some more, then go and have a rummage in the archives, see if there's any episodes that you've missed, or if you're, like, you're new to this, then go and explore the podcast. Other than that, there's loads of other stuff on Patreon. If you go over there now, you'll have access to over probably another 100 shows that are unique to Patreons over there as well. Everything you need to know off the beatentrackpodcast.com. I'm back next week. Stay safe. See you soon. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. PodBibleMag.com. It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.